Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
There we go, the official U.S. Navy Observatory time, 10 after.
10 after, okay. So let's may I take a moment for some housekeeping things?
Yeah, I have the syllabus up here.
Listen up, Seth, let me have your attention here. A few things. First of all, I'm going to pass around this list of your character names. If you've already chosen a craft, please write your craft by your character's name. For next class period, Thursday, you have two in-game assignments. You need to join the kinship. You were supposed to have done that already. If you have not joined the kinship with your primary character, beginning on Thursday, you'll get points deducted from your final grade. I mean, I don't want to be tough about this, but when we ask you to do something for the class, you know, you got to do it. And if that, you know, that's our only enforcement tool, so we're going to use it. And I also want you to pick a craft, if you haven't already, for your character. So the craft, yes.
What do you pick a craft?
You should be able to find that out as you emerge from Arshet.
We have a quest.
There's a quest that tells you what to do.
That's right. And it's very simple. And then there's a set of options, and you pick one that you think you'd enjoy. And I hope we'll get a decent distribution, because there are a whole series of craft quests that require you to ask friends who are doing other crafts to give you materials, so you get a lot of XP that way. So I know that we have a very full class. I'm going to hand it over to Matt in a second, but I just wanted to talk about that. I also will post a paper assignment for your paper that's due. Post the paper. It's due next. Is it due next Thursday?
Thursday the 13th. Rough draft of first paper due.
Okay, excellent. So I'll post that this afternoon or tomorrow on the website. And then people were asking when Lord of the Rings is due. You see on week four.
It's too glaring for you there.
Are we saying that the paper is due next class period?
There's a workshop. Yeah, a rough draft would be on Thursday.
I'm going to move that paper date to
tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm going to move the paper date to. I'm going to move it around. I'll move it to Monday. We'll move the paper date to due to Monday. I'll change all of that as soon as class is over. I'll put it on the syllabus and in Oak.
Oh, like you put the paper in.
You do put the paper in it. But that's too fast. It's snuck up on us. So we'll move the paper due date to Monday, and I'll put all that on there for Tuesday. So a week from today, you need to have read one-third of Volume 1 of the Fellowship of the Rings. So just plan ahead. Actually, if we're switching around when the paper's due, let's start reading Lord of the Rings for Thursday. So you need to read the Fellowship, one-third of the Fellowship of the Rings.
By day after tomorrow.
So I'll swap all that stuff. I'll swap the Thursday and Tuesday stuff.
Turn one of the things off.
A third of it?
Well, the first third would be 140. The third would be like, 140.
Yeah, it's not a hard reading. It's not hard reading. So I will make all those adjustments right after class. I apologize for having to rearrange the schedule a little bit, but it's too soon to make you write a paper for Thursday. Okay, that's it. If you've already picked a craft, write it here. Also check whether I have your character correctly listed here, and I'll turn the class over to Professor Hall.
How many people here did not, by the way, remember we are podcasting. There are the microphones in the center. If you want the point to be registered on your podcast, point at the microphone as well. You will help me watch that for editing purposes, as you did last week.
Okay.
So how many people did not get to look at the two podcasts on iTunes University? Raise your hand, please. So just one. So Jeff and Michael, you did not get a chance. Please go back and have a look at it. That's 30 minutes of content, which I think are very appropriate to this discussion. So I have a question for you guys. How many hours a day does the average U.S. home watch television?
Four.
Three.
Six. Second. I hear four.
Four.
Yeah, four.
I hear seven.
Three.
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 Three. Still sitting around 6 hours, 47 minutes.
Wow.
What percentages of the U.S. population can name at least three Chief Justices of the United States Supreme Court?
5%.
10%.
Come on, guys, jump in. This is an easy question. This is easy class participation points. He's watching you. 17 is the number. I don't know that I could right now. I'm totally disappointed.
Is that can or cannot?
17 can name at least three. 17%. What's the percentage of Americans who can name the Three Stooges?
95.
I got the number here, 59%. All right. How many internet users are there right now worldwide?
A billion.
2 billion.
Well, Matt Shelton, I think, said it.
Billion.
1.17 billion and growing. 70% of the homes by 2010 in the United States will be broadband enabled. That's 256 kilobits per second or higher in terms of speed. So how many people were connected to the internet in 1898?
Zero.
Don't act tentative about this. This is one of those things. This is a giving question. 1898, there was no internet for those of us who are.
The telegraph network could be.
Didn't they have those tubes in London where they shot things?
Yes,
vacuum
they had
tubes. That was a form of internet. So if you wanted to, this is not a joke. They had one of the most extensive tube systems. You know the tubes, if you go up to pharmacy, mm-hmm. you go up to banks, and they shoot those tubes all over the city of London. This is Dickensian times, and Professor Clayton knows very much what was happening with. Prince Albert and the bunch around that era. A lot of tubes. And what was the Crystal Palace, right? Crystal
yep,
Palace.
1851.
Time. 1851. That was the World's Fair there?
First World's Fair.
1851, Crystal Palace. Prince Albert, very interesting time that I think you should all be aware of. In the 19th century, guys, what forms of entertainment were there?
Reading.
Board games.
Sports.
Yeah.
Late.
Well, there's one more I think of immediately.
Theater,
reading,
music,
theater. Okay. Now, we may have some discussion about how much leisure time people had in the 19th century. It could be more, it could be less. It's kind of moot. The options for entertaining oneself were, what did you say again? Sports?
Music.
Theater.
Music.
Can someone write on the smart board for me and capture some of this when we go around here? Jeff's a smart board wizard. I know he's been a volunteer. There, get up there. Go on. This we have to get this out for our listeners on the internet to supplement. Jeff, it's Jeff's handwriting that's out here. So help Jeff out here. Come on, pick up and start going. We got sport, 1898. Write it right down. 1898. That's just for tickles and grins. What do we have?
Sports.
Yeah, that was entertaining, and they probably read about it.
It was entertaining.
And what do they read about it in?
Newspaper. Well, that was Yellow Journal.
Yellow journalism, that's right. Remember the Maine. You remember the Maine, right?
Remember the Maine.
Yeah, okay. You brought that up, I didn't. So I want you to remember the Maine.
Games?
Like
board
games.
Normal games. Or normal games. Peter's a board game is a normal game, unlike our abnormal games that we're all playing right now. Putting Jeff on the spot. If anybody wants to relieve Jeff, I'm sure he looks very tense up there. So
I'm about to start drawing pictures.
Well, draw a catcher. You know, if you have a sports football players, how was the NFL? How was the NFL in 1898? There was an NFL in 1898. Was there a Dickensian NFL?
No, just
polo.
So was there a lot of when people gamed in the 19th century? What had to happen? What were some key elements of gaming in the 19th century?
Can you interact with someone else personally?
Like, so could you game one person in Kent and another person in Glasgow?
No. You had to be with somebody.
Place to fetch.
Pen pal.
Social?
Pen pal. You could have been pen pal. It would have been a little bit time delay on your chess move, but that's true. You could do chess moves remotely, so there was play-by-mail. Right. But by and large, I think what Leslie's saying is accurate. We had to be face-to-face. What about when you enjoy a novel?
Personal,
yeah, you had to. Oh, with a good friend. Just paper. You ever hear the term, Professor Clayton, help me out here. This is Fabian S. sort of discussion, H.G. Wells time. Weren't there salons?
There were certainly salons. Mm-hmm.
And what's tell us about a salon.
Reading is a fundamentally solitary experience. Yes. You sit there with a book and you absorb it. But from very early on, there were literary discussion groups, which have actually come back today.
Literary discussion groups.
Become a great rage. But a lot of salon culture in Paris and in London, less in the United States, actually.
And now we've got the Oprah Book Club. People all over the United States, and it may be popular culture, but they're still talking about books. So discussing what you read was the extent that I would submit here for our discussion of interactivity in the 19th century. So let's fast forward a little bit. And this is important to me, that I hope that most of you had the opportunity to look at the podcast and the timeline. How many television networks were there in 1970? 1970, I mean. What were they?
ABC.
NBC.
CNBC.
I don't know.
CNBC.
ESPN.
CBS.
ESPN 7. Extreme Poker, right?
ESPN.
I think there were three to the best of my recollection. NBC. Get up there. Extend page. Extend page. Alert. Down at the bottom. There's a button. Extend page.
Just press it.
With this?
No, set it down.
Your finger.
It's not going to color it?
Give it a try. See what happens. It's not going to bite you. There you go. All right, so what do we got? NBC. So we're in the 1970s now, Jeff. Jeff's going to take us to the 1970s. NBC.
CBS.
ABC. CNN not there yet?
No.
I think it was maybe 79 or 80 when CNN came on the live. Turner Broadcast. It's right in that period of time. So essentially you had three networks. Did the networks have a schedule?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The networks had a schedule.
They were on the air all the time.
See, one of the things that I remember at the end of the night, to Wesley's point, was the American flag would come up. You remember? What was the phrase? Jay may remember this. I know I remember it. This concludes our broadcast day.
And about the video of the
I felt you stood up and you saluted the flag and
the airplane flying over the ocean.
How many networks conclude their broadcast day at midnight today?
Nine. Zero.
PBS.
A few. Okay. So the concept from 1970 to 2007 of a broadcast day is what?
8 hours.
Is there still a broadcast day?
I don't know.
So within 37 years, we've had a transformation in the way people broadcast. Have you thought about the term broadcast? Ever given it a wee bit of a thought? What does it mean when someone is broadcasting?
Sending information.
To a broad area.
Hum a few more bars on that. Say some more.
Just like a mass media, I guess.
Okay. Mass of what?
Information.
Is it mass of information, or is it a target audience that's the masses?
Target audience.
Probably you're looking to get a particular set of content to a broad audience. Who is interested in getting a little bit of your time on those mass media broadcasts? Who is really interested?
Cigarette companies?
Yes, cigarette companies, beer companies. And the operative term there is?
Advertising.
That's the end of the day. So you had this broadcast media that was subsidized by
Marketing.
And I love the old-timey ads, you know, and the radio shows and on the Ed Sullivan Show and Soupy Sales. I don't know if you know who Soupy Sales is. That's an obscure one, but interesting. So now what you have in the world, you think about 1898, we discussed it. You fast forward to today, and now you've got this visual medium. I skipped a lot because you can go back in the timeline and see what led up to that. The 50s, the 60s, and 70s, you really had three networks, and you had a situation where if you were going to have a pop culture experience, this may be before your time, but I'm going to try to lay it out here, because I showed you that class of 2011, that cutoff, right, to the left of that. These are things that happened before you guys were born. But there were two phenomena. And Jay, help me on the cultural mainstream phenomena. Roots was something that when you came to work after watching the series, the entire country was talking about this program. When you watched MASH, this is this 1970s, 1980s kind of model. Everybody was. Is there anything else you can think of like that? Who killed JR?
The Dallas. The Dallas. Yeah, the final episode of Dallas, one season, they shot JR, and the following September, you found out who did it. For the whole summer, the whole country was going wild about that.
Is there anything in the year 2007, with hundreds of broadcast channels, with YouTube, with hundreds of thousands of internet sites, is there anything that binds and brings people together in the same way as those mass media, those common...
Lost.
Say it again.
Football. 24.
The Super Bowl.
Maybe
Super
a presidential Bowl. Election. And one video with the kid, the Numa Numa kid.
See, but I don't know.
Okay. Well, I know.
But, you know, the presidential election is an interesting issue because they've been talking about the plummeting ratings for coverage of presidential elections. So election night is losing ground, but the Super Bowl is still there, perhaps. Natural disasters like... Or terrorist events, maybe big news events, possibly.
But is there something that would be analogous to the cultural phenomena that was Roots? I mean, I think I internalized that. Did you see this?
Of course.
It was provocative, and it was provocative, and it was a shared experience that the entire country had in common. Well, I mean, certainly people opted out of it, but by and large, if you only had three or four options on television, and you had these major television events, you had something to discuss. It's very similar to the book clubs of the day who read a selection off of the New York Times bestseller list. I will assert, and we can discuss and challenge this, but it's kind of a premise of what I want to discuss here, there is no binding culture because you want what you want when you want it today. The technology has evolved to a point where you can get what you want when you want it. And since you each have individual tastes, some people like the Super Bowl. Some people, and if you go to South America, can really not care too much about the NFL. What are they going to be interested in South America?
Soccer.
Football.
That's right. Football. Football. Yeah. And they are very animated about their football if you ever watch Univision and have a broadcast of anything related to South American soccer. So not the binding forces that we've had in the past. So. Have a think on this, and I'd encourage you guys if you want to look about internet behavior. It's the Pew Internet Project. Google that, the Pew Internet Project.
Write that up there.
P-E-W. The Pew Internet Project. In June of 2005, and there's various freshness, you guys explore that data, you'll find it fascinating. 67% of the adult population goes online in 2005. That number's only going up. Today, 34% of the U.S. adults, internet users, play online games. So 3 out of 10 people in the United States. Matt, you were always coming in here saying you're coming out of the closet on gaming. Well, guess what? It's in the mainstream now. Whether you're playing on Yahoo, on something as simple as a Scrabble-like game, or you're doing something sophisticated like this. P-E-W. Yeah. Jeff's like, how did I draw this duty? I don't know how this happened.
Plug.
First thing, Scrabble. That amazing sophisticated drawing.
Scrabble is sophisticated, but I mean, in terms of what it represents by analogy, you've got a very... And what would Scrabble be an example of related to Jesper Juul? Is it emergence or progression?
Emergence.
Say it again, guys, so everybody, say like
emergence.
You mean it.
Emergence.
All right. So it's an emergence game. A small set of rules that give us a large set of possibilities. I would argue, in terms of sophistication, Peter, that Lotro has a large set of rules, which gives us a large set of possibilities. So it's both emergence and
progression,
right? Scrabble is not a progression game unless you have an external ranking system in there. So have a think on that when we work through some of these classifications. It's not that it's not sophisticated and intellectually challenging. It's just, think about our categories, how we're looking at this. So by 2011, 87% of the U.S. population will be downloading their video content online. what's my point? Where do you guys think I'm leading with this topic? Why don't I present all these little factoids to you?
Show the growth of technology?
That's one aspect of it. Technology has grown in adoption.
Maybe more so how our culture is changing due to this changing technology, how, what our, you know, where we go, how we go, what we watch, and how we watch it.
I think that's it. Matt, what did you want to offer?
That was it.
Well, I mean, that's it. For me, the way I kind of encapsulate this concept, from publish to participation. This is the operative term, from publishing to participation. We've seen an evolution where clearly, and what Jeff wrote on the board about the 1890s, they were publishing things, whether you were talking about the USS Maine and Havana Harbor, or whether you were getting the news from London, people would have a reporter in the field, they would capture that information, write it down, and it could be days, weeks, and months before someone would hear what happened in a faraway land. If something happens in Afghanistan today, how long before we hear about it?
A minute.
5 minutes.
Yeah. We have compressed time and distance. By compressing time and distance, you can play LOTRO with someone from Japan. I played one, you know, with Australia. How many of you WoW people have played with international players over time? You never would have played a game with someone from Australia. Professor Clayton played a lot with because of his schedule. Were you playing England?
Greek, German, lots of Europeans. But WoW has less international participation because they have those dedicated European servers,
okay,
which keeps, you know, so you'll occasionally meet people from Europe in WoW, but not nearly as often as you will in LOTRO or some of the other games.
But it also helps.
Yeah, but in WoW, like Australians and Japanese, they play on the American servers.
That's correct.
Yeah. But I used to play a game where there weren't any separate servers, and there was a big language barrier too. Different people you couldn't really play with because they spoke French or they spoke Spanish.
I think you often get a kind of ability to play with people who are speaking another language, because the terms you need to know, the sort of, you know, when you hear them saying follow, follow, you know, form up, follow so fast, so many times, doesn't matter what language they're saying it in. You begin to have a kind of sociality beyond linguistics, a kind of understanding of how the group should work together regardless of language.
It's kind of transcendent in that regard. So it is, from publishing to participation. This is what I want to offer you. Now, the 1970s, what I hope to convey in those podcasts, the 1970s were formative. I was born in 1969. I grew up in the midst of this change. Pong was a major breakthrough.
No pun intended.
Pac-Man, you see this one here up on the board, Pac-Dasher. That's out on SourceForge.net. You can download this and play it. It's the closest approximation to one of the old arcade games that we have. When we get to this amount of technological innovation in the 70s, you see more and more sophistication. You see a couple technological and social things colliding. One, you see a lot of technical innovation. Personal computers, IBM introduced the first personal computer in August of 1981. There were kit computers, and this is where Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and everybody got their general start in this garage hobbyist area. The Altair came up in the 70s. They were kit computers for enthusiasts. And then as the mass market started to emerge, you started to get cheaper consumer electronics. What happens when you put cheap electronics in the hands of many, many people? What the concept at the time, the 1970s and 1980s, these visionaries, they kept saying the network is the computer. The network's the computer. What does that mean? It's not just each individual linear experience. The first games in the 1970s that you saw, games like, if I can figure out where Zork is here.
Zork.
Find the bloody thing, we'll be all set. Zork, you can see this here? A little bit because the lights, it's faded out. What I have on the board here is Zork, right? This was a typical gaming experience in the 1970s. Someone read that for me, that under the revision serial number, read what this says.
You are standing in an open field west of a white house with a boarded front door. There's a small mailbox here.
That's your gaming quality in the 1970s. Who thinks they would enjoy that? Raise their hand.
Moose munch.
Right now, for the listening audience, it's about half the class. Who would not enjoy it? Who would find that miserable? Again, half the class. Why would you not find this enjoyable? You're west of a house. You're standing in an open field west of a white house. What's not to enjoy about that?
Because now we can see it, and we have like an avatar that shows us standing west of a house, and it's like very clearly laid out for us, and I don't have to like...
Okay.
Yes.
It's very. Someone responded very clearly laid out. Why would that be an issue? Why is it a White House, Matt?
It doesn't really push your imagination as much. Like here, you have to really use your imagination so you can see yourself standing in the open field. Whereas it kind of hits a broader audience when you actually have an avatar, like he's talking about, standing there. It's not really impressive.
This is almost like reading a book compared to watching a movie. Like this requires so much imagination, and you like. Thinking about what's going on right now, like today, like we're spoiled in that, like we get all of that all the time.
Jonathan, you want to jump in?
I was going to say the exact same thing. I was going to say verbatim.
So Jeff, it just seems like imagination is used in Zork. You don't use your imagination in Lotro.
Less.
You don't need to use your imagination in Lotro. What do you think, Professor? Do you?
I use mine. Yes.
I have to suspend a little bit of disbelief. But so one of the things that Infocom, the company that produced Zork, which was, I believe it's MIT faculty, the first developers of this, if someone will fact check me on the internet on this, Infocom used the term interactive storytelling. They felt that this was a way to take, and this is something, Jeff, I'd like you to put on the board there when you have a moment, interactive storytelling on Zork. We're challenging Jeff. Jeff gets bonus points. And I'm going to buy him a Coke. So let me know when you want your Coke. I'll get it for you, Jeff.
Okay.
Interactive storytelling. This was a potential book, not replacement, but a different way to enjoy a story. So someone on my keyboard there, type open mailbox. Opening the small mailbox reveals a leaflet. Type get space leaflet. This is how you interacted with the story in Zork in the 1970s. What's interesting about this? Who controls the path of the story?
You.
You guys debate that amongst yourself.
I think there's only one outcome.
But it depends.
Yeah,
it depends.
What is an invalid command, and you have to do the one.
Then the person made the game.
What do you think that you can not open them?
Wait. He's going to kick the mailbox. Let's see what happens. Kicking the small mailbox has no effect.
Burn the leaflet.
Do read leaflet. That's what just.
Yeah.
Read leaflet. Maybe
it's.
That's actually you're reading it, but I think you're getting your point. If you type in INV,
you're king of.
This is what happens to your question. It doesn't recognize INV. Now type in the word inventory. I don't know the word INV. It doesn't recognize a command. You are carrying a leaflet. Well, guess what, guys? Now I'm going to go back. Who controls?
Programmer.
The programmer.
Both.
Okay, jump in here. This is important around the structure of interactive storytelling, if you want to help me out.
But he's controlling what you're doing.
The programmer has
the programmer is controlling what you are going to do.
You can do it however way.
They set out a stream of code that they have that the game can work under, but you, using your imagination by reading what's displayed there, you can type whatever you want, however you want, and then the code that they've established tells you whether or not that's valid in the game. So you can think what you want, and you can interact how you want, but eventually it'll come to...
This is the point, right? You're going to stay with me, big boy. You're going to get your exercise. You're going to do push-ups on the bed. Okay, so where do we have? We had a house, right? What did you get? You found a leaflet?
A
Isn't he at Dan Quayle's?
Well, this is just a...
It's a combo.
It wasn't a Dan Quayle moment. I had it there. It was just a legible A. So you have a leaflet.
It's a combo letter.
That's right. It's a squiggly combo. Thank you for it. So you got a leaflet. You got the leaflet. Now, there's going to be, which I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but there are going to be branches. And it's all about if-then logic. Ultimately, it reconverges onto an end game. I would submit, because we're really tight on time here, I would submit that the storyteller is not you. You're more participating in the story. You're offered paths. You can run up against something, but I think something that defines this is it's linear. Right? It is linear. You have to go through it in a certain order. To your point earlier, with certain commands, or you don't get success in the interactive storytelling. Wesley and Mike.
And if you think of something that the programmer hasn't thought of, then you can't do it. I mean, it's still all dictated by the programmer, and it's really not you in control at all.
But what about a novel? I mean, Michael responded to that. I want to move to the novel.
It's a lot like the Choose Your Own Adventure novels.
Yeah,
like never seen those, except in this one, you don't have the ABC choices listed for you. You have to imagine them.
Right.
Think of what you can do, whereas a Choose Your Own Adventure novel, you know, you have them listed out. Go to page 83 if you want to open the door and, you know, go into the room. In this, you just have to think about it a little more. You know, what should I do? Should I open the door? Should I run into another, you know, run back?
Are you guys familiar with the movie Big?
Yeah.
His idea with the comic books where they're electronic and you pick what happens next.
I like the several people who said, though, that there's that both of you all are in control of the story. It's true that the programmer has got ultimate control in most of it. Yet, compared to other linear forms, earlier linear forms, there was a little bit of interaction. And we shouldn't forget that, because you're on the road toward the vastly more interactive virtual worlds that we have to come. So, you know, just being able to choose which branch of the tree, if it's a cleverly designed game, will give you some interesting choices.
1970s, in addition to games like this found their inspiration from a genre called the RPG. What does that stand for? Three letters.
Role-playing game.
Okay, why do we know that? Who in here plays Dungeons & Dragons or has played Dungeons & Dragons? Come on, nerds. Raise your hand.
A form of, like, Neverwinter Nights is based off. Does that count?
It does count after a fashion, but I'm talking about...
The board game.
It's not a board game. It's a role-playing game. And I define it, and in here, I want to reiterate the definition if I can find the bloody thing real quick.
Well, we've got a dungeon master right here.
You be the dungeon master and I'll play.
Just someone read that for me. I think this bears repeating in this.
Players act out the role of characters. Closely approximates free-form drama and generally involves a group of players together in a room or around a table. Examples are Dungeons & Dragons and D20 Modern.
Try to find a good example. Hard to see some of these. What I want you to see is, if you see this attack matrix for monsters, here, this, you're passing around interesting bags. Do not lose these. These need to come back to me. And this side of the table, that person here.
20-second bags.
Pass around. These are dice. These are the combat resolution tools for the role-playing game. So take those dice out, and I want everybody who has the geometric capability to hold up a D20, a 20-sided dice. Okay. Who's never seen a 20-sided die before? Jeff hasn't? You got to get Professor Clayton hooked up here. Here's eight of them. Now, let me draw your attention here to this. Do you guys see this 20-sided die score for a monster to hit? There is an opponent armor class. This is a table. right? There's an opponent armor class. Everybody roll that 20-sided die.
25.
20. Oh, that's a critical hit. Look out.
Two's probably not.
You resolve your combat by looking at your die roll compared to your opponent's armor class. That's how combat was resolved. It was done around a table like this. There was no computer intervention. What happened was everybody resolved their combat. I'm going to try to capture some of these as we go along, so bear with me.
Jeff had his hand up.
Jeff, go.
Is that how combat resolved to today in computer games?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, but what's the difference?
Like, well, you don't know it.
It's not automatic.
It's transparent. All that mechanic, how the sausage is made, is hidden from you. You're able to see when you see the animations. They're only animations. Underneath that is die rolls, random numbers based upon your stats, the items you've acquired. It's the same thing. I'm going to pass some of these around as I illustrate it to you. I'm going to pass the monster manual around. Have a look at it. These are the monsters. And what I want you to, there's some dragons here. Just have a look at the dragons. Look at some of the characteristics on the dragons. Go quickly. These are the stats in the game. These are what powers and inspires the technology-driven games of today. So this combat, now the difference, I think, that bears some consideration, if I can find it here, can't see this all that well. So what I'm going to do, I'll put it in here. I'm going to just give you the introduction. This is a dungeon master. Peter, I'll get to you in just a second on that. This is a dungeon master talking to a lead character, a group of people around the table in their house with a bag of Doritos, pizza, Pepsi, Coke, whatever your poison is, and their D20s. And by the way, if you're a real nerd, you have a Crown Royal bag in which you place your dice. That's the apex of it. So the dungeon master has contrived, I'll put this up, a narrative setting, a backdrop. This is one of the classics. It's called a dungeon module. You can see it up here on the screen. The Sinister Secret of the Salt Marsh. We'll be copying this one out here. Premier adventure from the UK, which was very special. An adventure for character levels 1 through 3. So this is a low-level adventure. There is a story behind this module. So you have a context, a narrative context. You have a group of people, and the person who is the narrator, the master of the universe, is not a computer. It's a person known as a DM. What's the DM stand for? Anybody know?
Dungeon Master.
Everybody knows what a Dungeon Master is. So DM. And there will be one lead character who they've anointed in the group to speak for them. What are you going to do now? Lead character. We're going to light our torches and go down the steps. Dungeon Master, fine, but I'll need a marching order. At this point, the players either write down the names of the characters with each in its respective rank or place them. There are three painted miniature figures, which would be a 3D representation of the characters. So he's asking for how they're going to walk down the dungeon corridor. After a brief discussion, here is the information on this sheet of paper. We'll change it only if one of us is wounded, lost, or killed. Why are the gnome and halfling in the front rank? And it goes on. There's an exchange between it. This right here, if you want to have a look at it, this is some dialogue, and this is the Dungeon Master's Guide that I'm passing around on the left side. These are the rule systems and the mode of interaction that you had to have a social Dungeons & Dragons experience. Peter, you were going to say something earlier?
Oh, I was just talking about the transparency of the rules in video games. I forget, someone was telling me, it might have been someone in here, about how professional, or I don't know if they're professional, but really good Dead or Alive players. Dead or Alive is a fighting game for real system.
I've got it on Xbox.
But yeah, apparently people who are really good at it have looked up and have memorized the frames per second it takes every character to do every single one of their moves. So depending on how many frames per second it takes to do one move, they will respond with a certain different move. And so, I don't know, I just thought it was interesting that in the computer games where things are transparent, people are now like researching the mechanics themselves to become better at.
And I can tell you, in the D&D world, when we were all sitting around a table, people really memorized those rules. I can tell you, this game is what got me into Tolkien. This was the apex of the fantasy genre, and it pulled me into an interest of the Tolkien world. And you can see, particularly on what I want to pass around to you now, I'll put this up on the board quickly so you can see in the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the character. This is the player's handbook. Make sure we get a copy of this one in here. This is a 1970s player's handbook. If you're a player, go ahead and capture that for me. If you're a player, this is the only book you really needed. It was all the things that were relevant to you. Oh, he's going to do it. All right. Fabulous. You would see things, if you can see that, that's a wisdom table. Right? And it tells you from 3 to 18. Pick 3 six-sided dice. Those are the regular dice. When you've generated your character, I can walk you through it right now. Somebody roll 3 six-sided dice. We're going to roll for the wisdom attribute. This is how you would create your character.
6, 5, and 2.
So an 11 wisdom. You're barely able to be a cleric with the wisdom. There's certain minimum attributes you had to have. Each one of these, there were strength tables. So you had strength, intelligence, dexterity, constitution, charisma. Do you have comparable stats in WoW and LOTRO?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have something in D&D called hit points. What do you call it in LOTRO?
Morale.
Can you see the tie strongly between this, these really in-depth rule systems, and the fantasy-based or other RPGs of today, role-playing games of today? What I hope to convey is the tabletop role-playing games required a narrative setting. They also required very complex rules to resolve the conflict and move the story forward. So the tie between the two, to me, is very important. I'll leave it up on the charisma. Thanks, if you can capture that. The charisma table. But it's, I think character generation is incredibly important. Okay, thank you, John. Where does that leave us? Is Dungeons and Dragons emergence or progression?
Progression.
Your character's advancing level. Is LOTRO emergence or progression?
Progression.
Wesley, what do you think?
I think it's both.
Michael? All the Michaels? Speak up, I can't hear you.
Well, I mean, it's both. I mean, you do have the set rules. It's not like you can go do anything. It's not as limited as Zork, whereas, you know, Zork, you wanted to jump up. The game likely wouldn't understand that. Or in this, you do have many other options, but still, you're limited by the set of rules.
Get on there, go. Is this Pac-Man emergence or progression?
Emergence.
Why is Pac-Man emergence?
He can't gain levels or anything.
Wait a second, if he completes this level?
But you're not, it doesn't make you any better.
But your Pac-Man doesn't get any better? Is that the key distinction between progression and emergence?
Because if you advance level, you get a scrap return. But, you're not getting any better, but you're still at a higher level.
Let me ask you this. Is there a fiction behind Pac-Man? Gotta speak up, guys.
There's slight fiction.
Yeah,
they just barely tie
the
story together.
Yeah.
But there is fiction.
There's a slight... Could you play Pac-Man without the fiction?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. You can play Pac-Man without the fiction. You could really... Is the fiction really consequential to eating those dots?
No.
How many variations on Pac-Man do you think you've seen over the years?
A bazillion. Lunch.
Baby Pac-Man, Super Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man. I've seen all kinds of Pac-Man.
Well done, Pac-Man.
Well done. Is the fiction in an MMORPG... let's take one... World of Warcraft, is the fiction really consequential to the game?
It helps if you know it, but it's things like online resources that you can get where you can skip all the storylines and just know exactly what to do to level up.
Okay, so here's a thought. Who believes that fiction is consequential to the World of Warcraft, that it matters? Raise your hand if you think the fiction of the World of Warcraft matters to you. So I have, 3.5. Jeff's kind of off on another one. Who thinks that the fiction matters in Lord of the Rings Online?
More so.
Okay, I'm getting more. I'm 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Michael's kind of half and half. We've got half and half over here. Well, why somebody more think it matters to Lord of the Rings? I mean, underlying it, the mechanics are very similar between WoW and Lotro in terms of the game rules.
Because there was like a novel written about the Lord of the Rings, so like the game coincides with the book.
Well, there's an Azeroth history. I got stacks of books on Azeroth.
Yeah, comic books.
Yeah, but how do you talk to
Well, how many people who raised their hand for Lotro that didn't raise their hand for World of Warcraft and played World of Warcraft?
Yeah, I did both.
I have.
I personally think that there are resources, since World of Warcraft is so, there's so many people that play it, there are resources that let you skip, and it's not necessary to know the storylines in order to progress. You can just go on Alakazam or Thoughtbot and say, what do I do next? And you don't even have to think about it. You just type it in if you want to level up. If you don't want to be in the story, then you don't have to be. I think you can, but it's not. I think the difference is Lotro, you need to be in order to progress.
Yeah, go ahead.
One difference is that with World of Warcraft, there's a little more emphasis on grinding from what I've played. I mean, I haven't played so much. It's not so much the quest as Lotro is. Whereas Lotro, you don't get many experience points from killing monsters. You get most of your experience from questing. Mm-hmm. So the story is a lot more important than Lotro.
Have any of you ever read a novel based upon an RPG?
Yeah.
Raise your hand if you've read a novel based upon an RPG. Two of you. Have any of you watched a movie based upon a video game? Who's seen Doom, the movie?
Oh.
Okay, so I mean, come on.
Resident Evil.
Resident Evil is another one.
Final Fantasy, there was a couple of
So we start to see...
Lara Croft.
Lara Croft.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
There you go. So what do you see? And you see video games, fiction, has been brought into cinema and then placed in the books.
Halo.
Mortal Kombat.
Mortal Kombat. There's even a Star Wars Galaxies book, by the way, which
there's
I read.
A Baldur's Gate book. Street Fighter.
Street Fighter book? I didn't know that one.
Movie. It's coming out next year, isn't it?
Remember
the Street Fighter movie from a long time ago?
Yeah, Claude Van Damme or whatever it is.
So, guys, this crossover idea, think about where we were in terms of the interactivity. Does fiction matter to the game? Now, Professor Clayton, here's where I'd like you to kind of jump in here with me. All this technological innovation, you get what you want when you want it, you have your attention divided, not so much as a mass cultural experience in terms of broadcast model. You can all choose a different MMO. You can all choose a different thing. What does this mean? All of these choices, all of these topics we discuss, what does this mean to you in terms of your experience of literature? And before I turn it over to Professor Clayton, I'd ask you one thing. How many people, and this is not a quiz, it's not going to be held against you because this is an exploration. How many people really enjoy reading books? Really enjoy it? Don't feel compelled. I mean, they're just, you know... I mean, if it's you do or you don't, you know it in your heart. I don't know what the proportionality is in general population. I always have a book running myself. Whatever I'm doing, there's some pace at which I'm going through a book in its old school form. Not audio, not in an MMO, but in a linear, here's a presentation from the author to me. My question to all of you that I'd ask you to consider discuss, what does this mean, all of these innovations in entertainment, if anything, to the future of the novel, to literature, to short story, in that medium?
Well, I do think one thing that's changing, you know, the novel, you always see people like saying there's not as many good books, not as many good poets. It's because a lot of the, there's so many different types of media now that a lot of the writers, they're going to movies. A lot of the playwrights, you know, just they're all spreading out so much that the talent is being diffused. You've got all these different forms of media, so there's not as many great works because there's not as many novelists competing against each other that are of, you know, great stature.
People think that's true? It's factually. There are probably more novels published each year today than in the past two centuries combined. Well, let's say, certainly than in, there's more novels published each year than in all the 19th century.
For example? per capita or just
novels? No, just more novels. And so, and there are definitely more poets at work today than in all the 19th century put together. So, in fact, the volume hasn't fallen off yet. So this quality of greatness that you're correct to bring to the fore may have something to do not with the caliber of the work, but with the consensus among readers. When you have all these channels of entertainment, all these options for what you're going to spend your time on, you may just not be as aware of the fact that a great novel's been published this year as you would have been when Charles Dickens published his novels, and that was the event of the entire culture that year. Peter?
I mean, part of it's what defines a great novel, though. So, I mean, I think it's agreed upon that Charles Dickens' novels are great novels, mm-hmm. but, I mean, there are classics that I enjoy, but I think Charles Dickens' books are not classics that I enjoy. I really...
Oh,
I mean, I
oh
don't,
right to the heart.
They're, I mean, they're good books. There's a lot of stuff you can do with them, but I do not enjoy reading them. Uh-huh. And so I feel like there's a lot... You're with the diffuse, like, yeah. so many books... How are we to decide which ones are great and things? So I think a lot of sort of what we learn in English class is sort of the books that are defined as the good books sort of thing.
There's no doubt about that. And there's also a problem that most people are exposed to the classics too early, too young, so that you know books that I think you might find yourself enjoying in a few years, you're forced to march through them in junior high school and high school. And, you know, it sometimes harms your pleasure in a book to be forced to read it, particularly prematurely. You know, I'm not guaranteeing that you'll change and start liking a Dickens novel, but that, you know, I've had a lot of experience with talking to people that said, oh, I hated that in high school, and then they suddenly love it 5-10 years later. You got your hand up?
Oh, I'm stretching. But I completely agree. I had to read Lord of the Flies in sixth grade. That was definitely not sixth grade reading.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you just said. I think part of the reason I never got excited to reading books is because there was always the thought that, you know, I'd read this and then I have to write an essay on it through high school. So that kind of tainted the whole, you know, every time I was reading, it was like, oh, I got to look for themes and like all that. And kind of.
That's how we're going to ruin video games for you in this class.
The thing I think it's interesting, how does something become great? Who defines what greatness is? And to Professor Clayton's point, he just said, Professor Clayton's point, all boats are floating. I mean, all media are producing more media than ever before. And now you're in a world, and I wanted your blogs to illustrate this. Who's to say that what you're writing on that blog is any better or any less valid than critics who have a big place in the New York Times? What qualifies them? They've been hired by a name brand, and that name brand confers credibility. In a world of blog-based democracy, it's tough. Who sets the trends? Is there an ivory tower of people who define greatness? Is greatness defined as revenue at the box office? It's an interesting and difficult thing to discuss. So, have a think on the source of who defines greatness for you, what you enjoy, the validity of it. What I want to recapitulate here in terms of what we should walk away with is 1970s, huge period of innovation, both technically and in gaming. Gaming became more sophisticated. Look at the rule sets of the Dungeons and Dragons books, the dice, the rule sets. I mean, there are about 20 books in this one that made up the game system. It's huge. And it's very complex. When you took those two complex technologies and gaming infrastructures, you combined them to lead us to where we are today. And one of the things, and I know Jay knows this very well, there was the start of this in what I consider to be a game called Myst. Who's heard of Myst? Myst? You even used Myst in one of your classes at some point.
I used Myst back in the 90s. Right. In a class.
Myst was one of the first ones where it was really, here's the 3D art. It was no more Zork. It was, I'm going to paint that White House for you, and I'm going to tell you what it looks like, because I'm going to use the 3D graphics technology, and then I'm going to run you through the story.
And today we're going to continually move forward.
So I want to go back to this discussion we were just beginning to have about which has more story, World of Warcraft or LOTRO, Lord of the Rings Online. It's a very interesting question because, of course, WoW has a story. It began as a standalone game with a background story, and if you played that standalone game when the online game came out, you knew a little bit more about the world than if you would have if you just started it fresh then. So why is it that Lord of the Rings Online feels like it has more story to it than WoW? Matt, are you about to comment?
Oh, I was just going to say, because of the grinding and the quests, the more quests you have to do, you're forced to read. There is that little yellow line that breaks it down that says you have to kill six or whatever. But when you're scrolling through the beginning, you have to at least glance to see where you're going to have to go, what you're going to have to do, and you do catch some flavor text there of why you're doing it.
So one feature is a feature of the game mechanism.
Right.
That the game designers have planned to make the story a little more integral to the gameplay. Jonathan and then Peter.
I don't know where everyone gets this idea about, like, WoW, where you have to just grind to get XP. Uh-huh. And WoW, you have to do quests just as much as in LOTRO. I mean, when I level, I do quests.
Okay.
And some quests require you to grind, and that's the only time that you grind. But I also wanted to say that the story in LOTRO is more, everyone knows about it because there's a movie and there's a book published, whereas in WoW there's only a game.
So I think that is a crucial point. There's something out there in the culture surrounding the game that pre-existed the game. So it's not merely the game mechanics. It's that you were entering into a... You know, we talk about entering a virtual universe, but we had a virtual universe prior to the invention of the network, of the Internet. The virtual universe existed in one's imagination and in all those Tolkien fans. And for ages, for decades before the game came along. So the sense we have that there's more story. Let's just stipulate that there's not more story in LOTRO than in WoW. You know, that's sort of Jonathan's position. Let's stipulate Jonathan's right that they've got equal amounts of story. Nonetheless, LOTRO feels like a richer narrative environment because of a pre-existing cultural narrative that we've tapped into. And that pre-existing cultural narrative went back before Tolkien. That was part of my lecture about Tolkien's roots in romance. Our culture has been deeply embedded in the imaginative world that Tolkien was exploiting for at least 1,000 years. Peter.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, similar thing is that, I mean, I also played Lord of the Rings customizable card game. It's like Pokemon cards or Magic cards or whatever. Uh-huh. And I had a Hobbit deck, and that means, like, in Lord of the Rings, you have to advance through stages, and each stage your opponent puts down monsters and try to kill you. But you also have allies instead of just the Fellowship, so your Fellowship would be, like, Merry and Pippin and Frodo. And then the Hobbits that were your allies would be, you know, the Cottons and the Tooks, and they would all have different little bonuses for your Hobbits. And so I had a whole, you know, line of Hobbits on the game field. And so when I'm running around in the Shire in LOTRO, I'm meeting all these Hobbits that I played with that would heal Sam or, you know, make Frodo more powerful and let him kill the Balrog or whatever. But so that sort of adds to it. Whereas in Warcraft, the only thing I know is on the Warcraft 3 loading screens, it would be like, Azeroth, this is where this happened. Then it would be loaded, and then, you know, I would play. So I don't really care about the plot. I just know the little snippets from the Did You Know on the loading screens that kept me entertained while I waited for my game to load. So
you feel emotionally invested in LOTRO, Lord of the Rings?
I feel like, and the books and the movies, I know a lot more about the plot. And I feel like Warcraft, I just wanted to play the game, and I didn't really care about the plot.